And let me wind you back to the very beginning of our service, Genesis chapter 1. We heard it at the very start. The artist is at work, and I'll just remind you of the first three verses. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now the earth was formless and empty. Darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. And God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. I was trained as a scientist, not an artist. I know very little about art. My university degree was in geology, in fact. I had to sketch rocks, but never draw the colour. If I say anything about pictures, and I will be showing some pictures later, I must emphasise it's not my own knowledge. I got it all from this book. This is the book to read if you want to get a Christian perspective on the history of art and how we got to where we are today. And it's by Ruckmacher, is his name. It's a hideously ugly cover. Don't let that put you off. And this is the one that's on sale at the bookstore downstairs. If that's gone by the time you get down there, then let Roz know. She can always order you some more. Very helpful, though, to help you understand from a Christian perspective how art has developed over the years. But I was trained as a scientist. And some people express surprise, as if it was a rather strange transition to go from geology to theology, from science to Christian ministry. But actually, I have to tell you, it's not that strange at all. There are a great many scientists who are Christians, although we could always do with more. In fact, a higher proportion of scientists are Christians than artists. A scientific view of the world and a Christian view of the world actually fit together absolutely fine, rightly understanding both of them. But when I tell people I was trained as a scientist, I always find that people are particularly interested in what I have to say, my opinions, about the very beginning of the Bible. As if my knowing a little bit about rocks and fossils is going to help me understand those chapters of Genesis in ways not equally obvious to other people who can read them. I'm not quite sure why people think that would help me understand those verses more, but so people think. It also reflects another mistake, I think. As if it's scientists who have to say, if you want something that really counts, that it's scientific approval and rejection that should be decisive in our view of things. In our modern day and age, we can labour under a misapprehension that science is the final arbiter of objective truth. That if you really want to know what is actually going on in a given situation, the people you must ask are the scientists. Not true. Of course, science is very good at some things, and we know that, of course. Understanding the way things work, so we can have better medicines, better machines, better crops, and so on. Science has brought magnificent things to the world. But when it comes to other questions, like understanding love, appreciating beauty, explaining the meaning of life, to be honest, science is pretty useless. And certainly, to rely on science alone is like looking at the world through only one eye. One half is in two dimensions, and you can't see the other half at all. Deliver us from a world run by scientists and a scientific priesthood. It would be nearly as bad as a world run by church ministers. From a Christian point of view, to understand the origins of our world, you need the eye of an artist as much as the eye of a scientist. In fact, in the Bible, the very beginning of things is much more artistic description than a scientific one. It doesn't have much to say about equations or mechanisms. It doesn't remind me of the scientific papers I had to labour my way through in the course of my degree. But it does portray this magnificent picture of God's creation It's grand, it's spectacular, it's detailed, it's intricate, it's balanced, it's contrasting, it's colourful, it's textured, it's the most wonderful work of art by the greatest old master of them all. And in order to appreciate what he has done, in order for God himself to admire it, and to really take in the essence of all his good work, what do we find God doing? He didn't measure it. He didn't weigh it. He didn't cut it up and dissect it. He didn't sample it or analyze it in a mass spectrometer. He didn't work out and write down its governing equations. He stepped back. And he looked at it. And he saw that it was good. So do you want some evidence from this world that we live in to believe in God? Well, please don't think that the only way it can come is by scientists. As if I can point out some detail in geological history that's bound to convince you in a way nothing else can. Open your other eye as well. Step back and look at it. Good, isn't it? Beautiful, isn't it? And there is no equation or experiment or theoretical proof that is going to tell you more about that than you can already see on a starry night or a beautiful autumn day. Some scientists, who always tend to want the whole world for themselves, will tell us that there is no such thing as beauty, and that what we perceive and appreciate is in fact just a certain psychological response to particular kinds of sensory stimulus. And somewhere along the line, that gave us an advantage that helped us breed and pass on our genes. If there is anything such thing as beauty, they'll say, it was invented by our evolution. So some scientists say. Our instincts tell us something else, and indeed perhaps our reading of the theory of art too. That in some mysterious way, beauty came first, before us. That we are actually appreciating something that, in a sense, was already there before we ever looked at it. And that's what the Bible says too. That in creation, God was expressing something of his artistic character. Every day he makes a billion billion snowflakes that no one will ever see, just for the sake of it. You decide which view of the world you will believe. But make sure that you make your mind up with both eyes open, won't you? And if it's not merely about evolution, why do we appreciate beauty and enjoy our own artistic labours that don't make us money and relax when surrounded by the natural world? Well, we enjoy it because we are the final product of God's art, intended to be the greatest picture of all. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. We are God's self-portrait. We appreciate beauty. We try to create beauty ourselves because we are, in a small and limited way, like God himself. And to be creative is written into us. Just like a tuning fork resonates when the right note is sounded, so our creative instincts resonate when we see something that God has made. They strike a note within us. Our own appreciation of beauty stems from and looks back to the very beginning of things when God made us all. So it shouldn't surprise us that over the centuries, Christian faith has been closely associated with the world of art and has contributed indeed to some of its greatest achievements. In a great work of art, the artist lets you in to their particular view of the world, and if they're a good artist, enables you to experience it with him or her and to see the essence of it. Now here, for example, are some from landscapes from an artist called Jan van Goyen, working in 17th century Holland. And I've just picked these as an example, and only because Ruckmacher talks about them in his book, so that I know I'm not completely making this up. But he was painting at a time when the whole culture was very influenced by Christian biblical ideas. And his landscapes are not mere photographs of scenes. If you look carefully, you'll see that they're not realistic, as it were. You could never take a picture like this. He uses a very limited range of colours, and yet with amazing texture that perhaps a screen can't bring out. The whole screen comes alive. He paints broad, expansive skies and seas that are open to God. And this little world of human activity, of work, of rest, of play, is set against this great backdrop. It's not naive or idealistic. You can see that there are clouds in the sky, dark clouds. There are waves on the sea. The sails flap in the wind. There are dangers and difficulties. But there are blue skies above. And the whole picture is meant to connect our little experience of the world with this great big God around us. You may or may not like the actual picture itself. But do you perhaps at least get the point of what I'm trying to say? A Christian perspective can reflect in a work of art. So there's one example of a Christian view of these things. But here are some more pictures, some other works of art. And I have to warn you, these are rather different. But I want to ask the question, what view of the world does the artist portray in these pictures? This is by an artist named Eduard Munch, isn't that right, I think? Anyone know what it's called? The Scream. Yep, I think you can see why, can't you? Anybody know the artist here? Salvador Dali, that's right, the surrealist at the start of the last century. Let me have another one. Oh, more screaming again. Anybody know the artist here? Bacon, that's right. Francis Bacon. Not the Francis Bacon in the 17th century, 16th century, but the Francis Bacon at the end of the 20th century. Again, this is another scream. A bit more up to date. Recognise the work here of Damien Hirst, Away from the Flock. It is, of course, a pickled sheep. One of his rather less gruesome works of art. There are some that I don't think I could have put on the screen if I wanted you all to stay in the room. And then we mustn't forget Tracy Emin either. This is named Unmade Bed. And it is her unmade bed moved into an art gallery. Now, the chances are that you would not choose any of these for your living room. I suppose a few might go for the Dali, perhaps, or even the Scream, if they were really. But you wouldn't choose these for your living room, would you? You may even be thinking, and forgive me if I'm a little sceptical, you may even be thinking, well, half of that stuff is not art at all. And it's quite ridiculous and outrageous that these people get great wadges of money and adulation for producing it. It's just possible that some of you may be thinking that. And it may well be true. Far be it from me to pontificate on that which I know nothing. But that's not my point here. My question is, what kind of world were those artists portraying, helping us to live in? Muncher's world, with his scream, is full of paranoia and insanity. He was traumatized in his youth by the death of family members, his mother and sister, from tuberculosis. Dali's surrealist world is bizarre and disturbing, isn't it? Bacon's world is nightmarish and haunting. And, of course, Hirst and Emin bring you face to face with ugliness and unpleasantness and emptiness. And all of their worlds are worlds without God in the picture. Man now realizes that he is an accident, said Francis Bacon, that he is a completely futile being, that he has to play out the game without reason. You see, painting All art has become a game by which man distracts himself. And then he goes on to say how art has to get more and more extreme in order to be able to do that. And although we may not even want to call some of these folk artists, what they do actually does have a value, you know. They show us the reality of that world. They tell us a truth, and that's one of the functions of art, or at least part of a truth. They help us see reality for what it is, or at least part of reality. Shut God out of the picture, they say, and this is what you get. Now, these are extreme examples. Plenty of people who aren't Christian believers will still perceive beauty and goodness and produce beautiful works of art without believing in God. But we must all agree that these artists have touched on something true about our world. We have the instinct for beauty, but in our present experience of life, it has to compete with something else, doesn't it? So much in our world is ugly, disturbing, nightmarish, horrible, or just plain messy. Art doesn't actually have to be beautiful to be good. Maybe part of the purpose of art is to help us see ugly truths as well, so that we can recognize them, so that we yearn for something better. And if you're brave and honest enough, you will see that the ugliness portrayed is not merely out there, but it's also within as well. When Tracy Emin puts her unmade bed and her dirty linen on display for the world to see, she's actually saying, and I think this is what she would say, this is what my life is actually like. This is the actual truth of my life. That's the point she's trying to make, I think. Don't you? But she's done it rather well, if that's her goal. But what kind of picture would we paint? What heap of rubbish would be on display if we decided to put the inner truths of our lives, our thoughts, our hearts, on canvas or on a plinth? Because none of us are pretty pictures at heart, even if we cover that up rather well with varnish. Inside, we all know there is the greed, the selfishness, the self-righteousness, the anger, all the other features of present human existence. All kinds of miserable, ugly smears on the canvas. The image of God has been spoiled and corrupted. It's no longer what it meant to be. And so the Bible starts with a very beautiful picture, a wonderful landscape of all the universe. But very quickly it starts to paint an ugly set of portraits, pictures of the human heart. And if we're honest, we will see ourselves in those pictures. And so Jesus himself said, it's not what enters a person from the outside that makes them unclean. Or he could have said, ugly as well, couldn't it? It's not what comes in from the outside that makes us ugly. It's what comes out of a person that makes them unclean. From within, out of people's hearts, come evil thoughts, sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, greed, malice, deceit, lewdness, envy, slander, arrogance and folly. All those things come from inside and make a person unclean, is what Jesus said. So if art is good, it will show us all that we are not what the artist originally intended us to be. Maybe a bit like this picture. I don't know what this picture is. It's a picture of a wine woman, but I don't know who painted it. But as you can see, it's faded, battered, torn, and we, like it, have lost our colour. The original image of God in us is very hard to recognise. As we are now, we are not worth much. Nobody would want to hang us on our wall. Could there ever be any hope that we could be made beautiful again, full again? That the image would be restored in us? Times come in all of our lives when we catch a glimpse of ourselves as we really are now. And we wonder what we could, what we should have been in the artist's original imagination. Maybe that time comes as we simply look in a mirror. Or maybe when we leaf through old pictures and we see ourselves as children. A time of innocence and promise, we may think. Time when things really could have been different to what they are now. What's happened? Or maybe it comes when past decisions and mistakes catch up with us. Or when future hopes and dreams run away from us. When we suddenly hear ourselves talking or realise with a start what we've been thinking. And you think, was that me? What's happened to me? What have I become? Is there any way back to what I should have been? Well, in the world of art, it's amazing what can be done. Things can be restored, can't they? And the wonderful truth for us and our lives is that God is not merely interested in painting beautiful pictures on a blank canvas. He, through Jesus Christ, is also deeply into art restoration. He wants to remake the spoiled image as it was originally intended to be. In fact, miracle of miracles, he is able to take a spoiled image and make it even better than it would have been before it was spoiled. And so perhaps the most wonderful word pictures in the Bible are not the beautiful landscape at the start, or even the most wonderful panorama that you find at the end, but two little scenes in the middle. One scene is heartbreaking and tragic. Jesus, his own son, hanging broken and mutilated on the cross. He had no beauty or majesty to attract us to him, the Bible says. Nothing in his appearance that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and familiar with suffering. And that picture sums up all that was worst about us, all our guilt and shame and the ugliness of it, condensed into three little words: we crucified him. And the other picture is a garden. A garden, rather like perhaps your or my gardens, on a Sunday morning with an empty tomb in it. He is not here. He has risen, the caption says. And when you set that garden against the dark backdrop of the cross that went before, it is the most wonderful picture of them all. It sums up everything that our hearts cry out for. Fresh hope, new start, new life, a new creation. To be honest, the art analogy breaks down here at this point. It's as if the artist has painted himself into the picture as one of us in order to make us beautiful again. God's own Son became one of us and died and rose again in order to give us a new start on our way to being something better. And it's the promise of the Bible and the experience of Christians that if we put our faith in him, there is a miracle of restoration in our hearts. We are renewed, remade. The experience of forgiveness, the reality of the Holy Spirit in us, really does add up to a new start in life and a new destiny at the end of it. We're not just repainted. We're not just touched up with fresh colours. We're remade. We're reborn. We're very definitely a work still in progress in this life, but already starting to show the effects of God's personal attention, personal love, the touch of his restoring paintbrush on our lives. So as we've read from the beginning of the Bible, let's also read from the end of it. For the final picture is even better than beginning. According to the Bible, our present creation, with all its wonder and beauty, will be to the new one what a bulb is to a tulip, or a caterpillar is to a butterfly. We find in the book of Revelation symbolic language, of course, not literal language. but in its own way it's a description of heaven. Not just a natural world remade, but also the wonder of being people who are remade. Revelation 21, page 1249, verse 1. Let me just read a little to you. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth. For the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no longer any sea. I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride, beautifully dressed for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, Now the dwelling of God is with men, and he will live with them. They will be his people, and God himself will be with them and be their God. He will wipe every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death, or mourning, or crying, or pain, for the old order of things has passed away. He who was seated on the throne said, I am making everything new. And here is the artistic genius of our God. He doesn't just make new things out of nothing. He makes new things out of old things, beautiful things out of ugly things. And maybe our own attempts at beauty and art are not just a memory of what God has done in the past, but also a dream that we all have inside of us of what God is going to do in the future. Maybe it's our urge to bring a little bit of heaven to earth. And the most beautiful thing about heaven will not be the wonder of a new creation, not even the joy of a restored human race, but the fact that God himself, through Jesus Christ, will be there in person. We will know the artist himself, face to face. And that is where our lips run out of words and our paint box runs out of colours. Because our minds now cannot possibly imagine how wonderful that will be. But it will be great. And if you have faith in Jesus, then the promise is that you will be there to see for yourself.